Fourth and final hour on this Monday afternoon. Hope everybody's having a good day. Darren McFarland and Willie Donick here with you. I know our next guest is probably having a good day. What a weekend. And it started on Thursday for him as his Commodores get the sweep of the Florida Gators, and they do it in a big fashion. Beat them 5-0 on Thursday, 15-2 on Friday night, and 14-4, beating the Gators in a three-game sweep. There over at his house. Tim, how you doing?
Good, T. How you doing?
Doing fantastic. Did you fill out a bracket at all? And if so, who do you have winning it all?
Oh, no, I don't touch that stuff. I just stay in my lane. But I watch it with enthusiasm, as you guys do too. That Duke game was unbelievable last night or yesterday afternoon. But it's a good time of year. It's really when you can see the emotions of the kids, and that's what I enjoy the most.
Can I ask you a silly question before we talk about your team?
Sure.
Let's just pretend Taco Fall could play baseball. Let's just say he was really good at baseball, and you've recruited him, a 7'6" kid. Where do you play a 7'6" kid in baseball? Has he got to be at first? Where do you put him?
Put him at first base, because of the obvious reach.
Mm-hmm.
If he could throw a ball at all, I'd love to see a kid like that throw a ball to the plate, because the reach to the plate, it's almost as if he's reaching out to the catcher's mitt and dropping it in his mitt. That brings back memories of Manute Bol, but even a bigger version of Manute. That was fun to watch as well.
Yeah, he could have those long strides in the outfield, right?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's a different type of player.
Let me throw one at you, Corbs, along the lines of just what we watch in the tournament at this time, where you have everything on the line in those big moments, and it's so close, the difference between winning and losing. And I know you as a coach, it's the same kind of thing. It's in baseball, I guess the 2 out of 3 makes it a little different in say, a super regional, but the ability to condition your players to be able to play their best in moments like that, because it's so easy to get caught up in all of the craziness and the chaos that starts happening.
It really is. I mean, that's the eighth and ninth innings, you know, for us, and it's the times where the game's on the line and you get into the plate with a guy in scoring position, or the ball's being hit to you, or you're a pitcher that, you know, a closer or a finisher that's going into a game. There's a lot of internal emotions that occur that, from a competitive standpoint, that's really when you start to understand the fibers of a competitive athlete. You know, whether it's Zion going to the hoop yesterday, that one, you know, towards the end of the game where he just went right to the hole, and come hell or high water, he was going to put the ball in the bucket. It's those instances right there where you start to determine the people that start separating themselves in sport. And they're the difference makers for sure, but it's certainly a tough situation to be in, and not everyone can handle it.
Why did this three-game series work so well for your kids?
Well, I think the first we had a pretty good matchup, and I say that with respect, because they had some very good starting pitching. They had three right-handed starting pitchers, but at the same time, I thought that, because we're generally left-handed in the lineup, I thought it was a decent matchup for us. Now, you know, they could have outpitched us for sure, but I thought we did a nice job midway through the games, each game, to capitalize on them and then get to the bullpen. So I think that was the first thing. And then I said, secondly, I think our starting pitching had to pitch well, and we pitched decently, but I was still, we've got a long way to go. We still got to get a whole lot better. But I just felt like this weekend, our starting pitchers gave us, certainly Drake because of his complete game. Ravy got us to the seventh, and Kumar got us to the seventh. And that's very difficult to do inside this conference. So I think with that and the way our offense swung the bats, I thought it was a pretty good weekend for us.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I wanted you to follow up on that because, as you mentioned, Drake Fellows got the series going with the shutout, the complete game shutout on Thursday, and Friday and Saturday. The pitching was really good, but you said they can get better. They've got things to work on, so maybe take that a little bit further. What would you like to see more out of your starting pitching, your rotation?
Well, I think better counts, number one. I think we haven't always worked in the best side of the count. But I think the other part of that is just the free bases that we've been exposed to earlier in the year. And I know that can dissipate. And it's a lot like free throw shooting. If you talk too much about it, then it seems to go in a different direction. And you don't want it to do that. You want the kids to be able to figure it out themselves. But at the same time, when you get bitten by it, like we did against Texas A&M on that Saturday, then it starts to impose its will on you, and you just can't give up too many free bases. Now, we distanced ourselves both on Friday and Saturday, but if we're looking for ways that we can grow as a group, it's certainly that. We got to better ourselves defensively, too, although we played pretty well this weekend. And then we're going to have to better ourselves, too, as left-handed hitters against left-handed pitching, because we know that's coming. We don't always align ourselves properly with the other team. So those are areas that we still need to grow in.
Because you've been doing this for so long, I'm always curious, because you hear this on the basketball side of, well, you've got these dynamic freshmen, but the team is extremely young, and unfortunately all the guys you're counting on, they're freshmen. Or you see, you know, the teams that are seasoned and they've got a bunch of juniors and seniors, you know, with less talented, but they're making the long run in the tournament. You as a coach in baseball, what is the right balance? What would you like to see? Because you've got some dynamic freshmen. You've got some experienced seasoned guys. What is the right balance for Tim Corbin to have a successful team that can make a long run when it comes to kind of the age variation?
I think, well, definitely balance throughout. You know, you'd like to have a balance in class, but you'll never get that really in college baseball. If you're worth your salt, then you're probably going to lose some seniors or juniors to the draft. And we were fortunate that some juniors came back and became seniors. And those are your best recruits. When you can actually get guys who have played in your program for 2 or 3 years and that have, you see them as opportunists from a leadership standpoint. And I say leadership standpoint in terms of their investment in the program, their investment in other people, then I think that does a world of good to your team. And really, I think that's helped us out a lot. We've got seven, not all seven play, but all seven understand their role. And having seniors that are older, that aren't playing, who don't understand their role, can be a tough dynamic for a team. And we're very fortunate that we've got kids that do understand their role and are willing to do the things they need to do in order to continue to grow the program. But I think if I had my druthers, I would tell you that give me five seniors every year that have played in your program before. Because if they played in your program before, they've got a chance to be very dynamic inside your organization as a whole. And I love these seniors. I really do. It's part of Donnie's class, but you know what? They never show up and think that they've heard it all. They never listen to me and respectfully don't listen. They listen like it's the first time they've heard something. That's tough to do. You know, you're in a program for 4 years. It's really tough to do. They can still be taught. And, you know, the Izzo thing probably had a lot of momentum in terms of how people felt about it. But I think generally speaking, people enjoy that. People enjoy an older coach who can challenge his kids in a way of, I want better for you. I need better from you. And there's not a lot of coaches who can get away with that. You know, there's a lot of young coaches who don't like confrontation. But I think that, you know, the older coaches, whether it's Roy or whether it's Krzyzewski or whether it's Izzo or, you know, even Wooden, they had a way of confronting their younger players in a way that they wanted to seek out more in them. And that's for me, that's great to see. And we've got seniors who you still can coach that way, and I enjoy that.
We're talking to Tim Corbin. Vanderbilt baseball coming off a sweep of the Florida Gators. They've got Lipscomb this week, and then they've got three with Tennessee at Hawkins Field this weekend. And, Corbs, I want to ask you about Kumar Rocker, because when you watch a few pitches of him at his best, it just jumps off the page. You say, wow, look at that stuff. But this is the challenge, I'm sure, that you've had over the years and your great pitching coaches that you had, Scott Brown now. But going back to the days when you had guys like David Price and Sonny Gray, very talented guys, but you're jumping in. I would imagine he hasn't been challenged by a lot of lineups he's faced, and he's having to learn how to get through the tough times, even though he's got this electric stuff. And if he were, say, off on some minor league field with no crowd, you could, you know, they work itself out. But you're trying to win at the same time he's getting this valuable experience. So tell me about the development when you first get a talent like that.
Well, you want to be slow with them if you can, because I think sometimes you can speed them up too quick. And if you don't have a roster situation that enables you to slow them down, then he can go down first before he goes back up. I think the thing about him is he's a willing participant. He's a willing listener. And he's a very good investor. He comes to the ballpark every day to make a difference in himself. And he's pretty mature. He's pretty mature for a younger kid. But I think their development is just based on their ability to get in that seat as a young kid who's talented and say, okay, I'm just going to open myself up to be teachable. And if I'm teachable, then I realize that I will pick some things up and I will learn and then I'll try to improve. I think where there's similarities to he and Price is their dugout mannerisms. When they're in the dugout, they don't miss a pitch. He's very intentful on how he watches a game and he doesn't miss a pitch. That's a guy that you want keeping a chart in between his starts because he's on it. He's by himself. He's watching. He's in the middle of celebrations, but at the same time, when the game starts, he doesn't. He follows, and when it's over, his emotions are dictated by the result of the team. So if we lose and he didn't pitch, he is fully, fully into it, and you can read it on his face, and you can read it in his body language, and none of it's manufactured. The kid wants to win for the team, and I love that about him.
Boy, that's a good sign. One more for you. Too, and yeah. This is something that happens a lot. You watch the evolution of a pitcher go from a guy that maybe jumps in, becomes a starter his freshman year, then the second year, maybe he's throwing the second game, maybe still started the third game, and then the following year he's able to take on that Friday night start. And you can explain it to people how big that is. You're facing the top pitcher on the other team. Drake Fellows looks like he's really seasoned that role, and obviously he pitched a great game for you in game one last Thursday.
Well, he's pretty consistent, too, in how he goes about things. And he was in that role last year. And he never, I don't want to say lost it, because I don't want any pitcher to ever feel that way, because I tell them that whether it's Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, it's a crucial game. But he's just stayed there, and he stayed there because of his mentality, how he goes about it. There's not a lot of dips and dives in what he does. I mean, he's pretty consistent. He's a pretty consistent winner. Does the same thing all the time. He's durable. And I was just happy for him that he was able to get through a lineup three times, get through the game, and never come out and finish it. And that's just very difficult to do, and it's very difficult to shut out a team, especially Florida, who had a lot of returning hitters. So, Drake continues to get better, and he's going to. And he's a kid that, you know, we've just been fortunate to have. You know, I don't know what he will be seen as when he leaves Vanderbilt, but I see him right now as one of the most consistent pitchers we've ever had.
I should know this as we wrap this up. Is tomorrow at the Hawk, or are you at First Tennessee Park against Lipscomb?
Yeah, we play Belmont and Lipscomb at First Tennessee Park. We went to that model 2 years ago, and it's worked out pretty well. So we'll be over there for the last time this year.
Awesome.
Was it 6:30? And we're home team this year, so that'll be good.
That's awesome. So Lipscomb at First Tennessee Park tomorrow night, 6:30. Yeah. Then a big three-game series against Tennessee. And that's going back to your Friday, Saturday, Sunday, more your traditional three-game series. So you'll have that at home on this weekend as well. So this is going to be a big week for you guys. Thanks for doing this, Tim.
Okay, say hello to both your wives. Thanks a lot, guys.
We will do the same, and you pass along to Maggie as well. Tim Corbin, it is going to be a big week. Coming off the sweep of Florida, they beat Belmont at First Tennessee Park on Tuesday, so a 4-0 week for them. Can they do it again? They'll be challenged this week, but it is a very, very good Vanderbilt baseball team. There's some news on the Predators front we'll pass along when we come back on 102.5 The Game. Dino Gaudio at the bottom of the hour. Catch up with him in about 10 minutes or so. Talk a little bit more college hoops with Dino. some news on the Predators front. They're in Minnesota tonight to take on the Wild. And boy, we talked about what a regulation win or loss could do for the Predators in Winnipeg on Saturday. We know now what that meant. It probably means, this is the reference I used on Saturday night, the door is probably shut. It's not locked, but it probably shut on the regulation loss in Winnipeg of winning the division.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's not locked, but it's shut. You can probably shut the door on Minnesota with a regulation win tonight. It's not locked for the Wild, but it depends on what everything else, how everything else plays out. But you beat them in regulation tonight. That chance for them getting in gets harder and harder, especially if things don't go their way with other scores. So just throwing that out there. So with that being said, they're in Minnesota. We told you last week that Rem Pitlick had been signed. We had talked to David Poile about Rem Pitlick in the last couple of weeks, and his season has ended at Minnesota. A tremendous season for him, 45 points, 21 goals, 24 assists. And he had joined the team. He was in Winnipeg with the team on Saturday, and it looks like, and this had been thrown out there because of where they are, but also I don't think this is why. We didn't bring this up earlier, Willie. Rocco Grimaldi got hurt late in the second period. He did not return. He did not play in the third.
Yeah, and I thought he played a strong first period for sure. I don't think anybody played great in the second period there, but he was playing well. So I'm not sure. I have not seen anything reported that Grimaldi is officially unavailable or anything, but I would imagine that has something to do with it. But Rem Pitlick is going to make his debut tonight at Minnesota, and that's significant because where did Rem Pitlick play college? Where did he just come from? The University of Minnesota, playing in the Big Ten, where that's a big deal up there. You might say, well, college hockey or whatever. But in Minnesota, I would say the following for the Minnesota hockey program is similar, if not bigger, than the following of the football and the basketball. I mean, it's right there, if not bigger. And basketball's got a pretty good following. Football's got a pretty good following. But the Gopher hockey program, big, big-time stuff. So that's an interesting scenario to make your NHL debut right there in the state of Minnesota. So we'll see how he responds. He'll play, according to the projected lineup on NashvillePredators.com, he'll be playing with Kyle Turris, and Mikhail Granlund. Interesting line. So opportunity. Remember what happened last year? They put Ellie Tolvin in there, and it just nothing really happened. So it's just such a wild card, but there's nothing else you can do but throw the guy in there and see.
Well, if anything, gives you a look at him.
Just a look.
So you find out what their skill set is. It's going to be obviously difficult. It's his first game. But you learn a little bit more about that player. And so I see no harm in doing that tonight and see what you have in him. Now, the other piece of news is the other guy that we've talked about. We've brought this up with David Poile as he joins us every Tuesday on the program at 11:15. And that is, of course, former first-round pick Dante Fabbro, who's been at BU, and they haven't had the season that everybody thought. Last year we were talking about them making their run to the Frozen Four. His season has now come to an end. And there's news out there on that front.
Apparently. We'll see. They lost on Friday. So Boston U season was over on Friday. The team was up in Winnipeg. So the sort of Fabbro watch began there. Now, there's still been nothing from the Predators on this. So I want to emphasize that it is not official from the Predators' end. But Chris Johnston, who is, you know, pretty formidable writer. He is with Hockey Night in Canada. He is with Sportsnet. He has tweeted this out, that Dante Fabbro has decided to forego his senior season and sign an entry-level contract with the Predators. Big news for Nashville. That's their 2016 first-rounder. And, of course, we know the deal. If he had played one more year of college, he could have waited Jimmy Vesey style. So that's a good sign. Waiting to hear the confirmation from the team itself. But Dante Fabbro, I absolutely believe, too, will get an opportunity once he gets to Nashville or gets with Nashville to play in a few games here to see if he is ready for the big time. It's a lot to jump in there, but history is filled with some guys who are just that kind of guy that can jump in there and be an upgrade and help a team in the playoffs even. There's some guys that don't even get the chance to play any regular season games. Chris Kreider did it a few years ago. The kid up in Boston, Charlie McAvoy.
McAvoy did it.
Came right in there and played pretty well.
Greenway did it for Minnesota.
Yeah, and he got some regular season games in. But, Greenway and Fabro were teammates up there at Boston. So we'll see.
Dante Fabro put this out on his Instagram page. Thank you, Terrier Hockey, for making the last 3 years at BU the best experience of my life. To the coaches, athletic department, fans, and my teammates, it's been a ride. Thank you guys for everything. Looking forward to the next chapter with the Predators organization. That's Dante Fabro on his Instagram page.
So just the final thing will be the official announcement from the team, and barring any craziness, and there's always some details you have to work out there, but it sounds like it's moving in that direction.
He wore what number at BU?
I don't know.
17. It's not going to be 17 with the Preds.
Yeah. If you're curious, Rem Pitlick is number 16. I don't know what Fabro will wear. Good question. That's what everybody always wants to know.
Well, it's not going to be 17.
Yeah, I figure not.
So we thought we'd pass that along. Rem Pitlick, it looks like he is set to make his NHL debut with the Predators tonight against the Wild up in St. Paul. And it looks like Dante Fabro has indeed signed with the Predators, according to Chris Johnston. And I just read you his Instagram page. He just told everybody at BU, thanks for everything. I love these 3 years. On to the Predators organization. So we'll see when the Predators decide to make that official out there, but we wanted to pass that along. We'll come back and talk to Dino Gaudio about what we saw over the weekend. We'll get into all that on the hardwoods. That's next on 102.5 The Game. It's been 10 years, a decade. 2009, last time seeds 1, 2, and 3 all advancing to the Sweet 16. Probably why my bracket's in pretty good shape. I picked a lot of favorites, and it actually played out that way. Willie, we've talked to this guy when he was a college basketball analyst at ESPN. Now he's back on the coaching sidelines as an assistant at Louisville. We always enjoy talking to Dino Gaudio. Dino, how you doing?
I'm doing great, fellas. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for doing this. You know, we had a little fun with Tim Corbin. He's Vanderbilt's baseball coach earlier this hour, and we said, you know, if you had a 7'6" player, where would you put him? And, of course, you know, he said the obvious choice would be first base, but, man, if he could run and had an arm, I'd have him in the outfield just because of how big he is. But what a dynamic, and how fun was that game yesterday?
Yeah, that was great. Hey, how about if we put Taco on the mound at 7'6", and that when he takes that stride and he lets the ball go, he'd probably be, what, 10 feet away from the batter?
Would he be that? Yeah.
He probably has a pretty good tilt on a slider, too.
Yeah, if he had some nasty stuff, can you imagine him on the mound? Wow.
Yeah. But what a great game. And give Johnny Dawkins a lot of credit. You know, he rolled the dice and put, you know, Taco on Trey on the point guard and then left him in the lane. And sometimes when you're an underdog and you feel like, hey, I got to make some adjustments. If we're going to beat this team, we got to go out of what might be the norm for us. And it, you know, worked really, really well. I just feel bad for Johnny and you know, Aubrey, his son, played so well, and if he'd have just, you know, he might have got pushed a little bit, but if he'd have just boxed out on that left side of the lane a little harder, you know, Barrett maybe doesn't come up with that offensive rebound off the free throw and put it back in. But man, a lot of emotion when you play against people that you like and love, like Coach K and Johnny Dawkins. That's a tough game to go against somebody, especially in the NCAA tournament.
You've been in this for so long, and you've seen all this, and I want to ask you, how tough is it? Because from an outsider's perspective, just watching, you're screaming at your television, you're like, what are you doing? How could you let this team come back? I mean, certainly Tennessee fans experience that. They're up 25. They're in cruise control against Iowa, and then all of a sudden, and you guys experienced that this year at home against Duke. You're up, what, 24 midway through? What is that like going through as a coach whenever you can feel everything shifting momentum the other way for the opponent and you're trying to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing a little bit of Dr. Phil in those huddles. I mean, you're talking to these guys, and it's like, you know, like when they're starting to cut into the lead, you know, I remember, like, the coaches were huddled up, and you know, I jump into our huddle with the players and say, let me tell you guys something. What you're thinking right now is really, really important. You got to believe that we're going to finish this thing off, right? You start nodding, and they start nodding. You know what I mean? Because as it starts to slip away, the psychological part of it is so important. And then a second time when we go into that huddle, and now all of a sudden it's like a four-point game, it's like, fellas, we need to be aggressive. We're playing a little too tentative right now. Listen, if we're going to make a mistake, let's make it on the side of aggression instead of being on our heels, and you're just trying to get them to believe in that, to be a little more aggressive, to be a little more assertive. Because as we all know, because I do it as a coach, I'm taking a peek at the scoreboard, how much time's left, and you're waiting for that darn thing to run off the clock there. But it's difficult. And, you know, I just have great respect for Tennessee. And I told people all along, and we played Virginia twice, I think that's the team that's going to go ahead and come out of that South region right there. You know, we played them up in Barclays earlier in the year, and there's not a team that we play that was tougher, more physical than that Tennessee team we played. And I think all of those ingredients bode well. You know, they keep moving along here, and if they end up playing Virginia, and I love Tony Bennett, and we both play pack line defense, but I just think Tennessee's a really, really good basketball team.
We're talking to Dino Gaudio, assistant coach at Louisville. And Coach, this is one of the reasons why we had you on. You've played so many of these teams here. But real quick, let's talk about your program, the one you're involved with now. I've always enjoyed watching Chris Mack's teams. And coming over to Louisville, jumping into the situation you guys did, how did you guys assess the season? I thought you guys had a pretty solid year given the tough schedule. And you know, when you get to the tournament, it's never a bad year.
No, it isn't. You know what, guys? When we took the job in April a year ago almost, and they just said, hey, listen, you're going to win 20 games with one win in the ACC tournament. You're going to win 11 ACC games and go to the NCAA tournament. I think we'd have had a parade. We would have been excited as could be. Because when we got the job, we had seven guys on scholarship. And then we went out and grabbed three graduate transfers because as we looked at the 2018 recruits sort of in April and May of last year, we didn't think there was anybody that could come in an impact force, and we needed to do that. So we picked up a really good point guard in Christian Cunningham out of a graduate student out of Samford down in Alabama. We picked up Quan Four out of Richmond and a young man named McCoy Agal who had three knee surgeries, two ACLs that came in and stabilized our front court a little bit. And those guys are really instrumental in turning the thing around for us because you guys know there was so much negativity surrounding the program. And when we came in and give Chris Mack a tremendous amount of credit, he told those kids, like, hey, we got an NCAA tournament team here. You'll never hear me say, when I get my guys, when we bring in our guys, you're my guys. We're going to win. We're going to win with you guys. Now, we were disappointed the way we played against Minnesota. And you know, that's not the standard we want to set here, like just going to the tournament. But in hindsight, I thought we had a good year, not a great year, a really good year under somewhat adverse circumstances. But I told Richard Pitino this. We were sitting down before the game. I said, Richard, you tell your dad that these are really, really nice kids that we got in this program, and they want to be in the gym. And I don't know if, you know, he finds any solace in that, but they were great kids. And you know, the prior staff deserves a lot of credit for the young men that were here when we got here.
Dino Gaudio is with us. And, Dino, I want to ask you about something I'm seeing a lot. And the range of some of the shooters now is really pretty impressive. Where you can go, they already moved the three-point line back a few years ago. Now you guys, you see now people very comfortable shooting from the NBA line, maybe a little further out. And you have to defend these guys. They're going to make the shots. And so with that, I'm seeing more three-point shooters getting fouled. I remember when I was playing, that was like the kiss of death. You could not foul a three-point shooter. But now it's like you have to contest those shots. Tennessee fouled a three-point shooter at a critical spot yesterday. UCF's three-point shooter got fouled by a Duke player. It seems to be happening more. I guess it's a credit to the shooters.
It really is, and I agree completely. These guys have such – we have a kid on our team now, Jordan Wara, and another little guy, Ryan McMahon. And I'm telling you, they're shooting from a good 3 feet behind the NBA line. And, you know, when we practice and when we do shooting in practice, we'll shoot threes from the collegiate line, and we're always saying, hey, start at the NBA line, left-right if you're right-handed, step into the shot, left foot, right foot, and then I'll tell you what, I'll be honest, we practice shots beyond the NBA line. Now, when I was at Wake Forest, you know, whatever it was, 8-9 years ago, if my guard coaches were doing that, I'd be screaming at them. Are you guys out of your mind? Where the heck is he shooting from? But you're right. Kids have deep, deep range now, and subsequently you got to go out and guard them. And we know, A, you have to defend a three. You know, and as coaches, we're all screaming, never foul a jump shooter. Never, never, never foul a three-point shooter. But that's how you're starting to create so much good spacing as well for you on an offensive end when you have guys that could shoot like that. And, you know, we see that from the NBA with Golden State and how that trickles down to our game. But I agree. There's, you know, we'll watch kids on tape, and I'm watching film on guys, and I'm going, damn. He is out there deep. And we'll show those to our players. Like, don't be surprised when he lets this thing go. And don't be surprised if it goes in. We got to press up and get out there and get a hand on these guys.
It was interesting to watch UCF. They went the opposite way with a lot of Duke shooters, daring them to shoot, just backing off further, saying, no, here, I'm not even going to come out at you. You shoot this and we'll take our chances here. What that looks like that's how you're going to have to try to defend Duke. How did you guys try to go about it?
Yeah, we felt the same way. We didn't think they were a great three-point shooting team. We had to try to keep them out of transition. And your offense has a lot to do with that. Mike's now a little bit more out in passing lanes like he used to be when we first jumped into the ACC when he had Jay Williams and those guys. So, number one, to beat Duke, your offense is an important part. And I don't mean that from just a scoring perspective, but you can't turn the ball over against them because they're so good, they're so athletic in transition. You want to make it a five-on-five proposition from a defensive perspective when you play the Blue Devils. And we did a really good job of that. That's how we got off. And then what we tried to do to negate Zion a little bit, especially on the boards, we told our point guard, like when that shot goes up, we want you also running in and try to put a body on Zion so that we would have sort of two guys boxing him out because the other team's point guard isn't going to go to the offensive glass. His responsibility is conversion defense. He's going to get back defensively. So I'll tell you, for the 3 days prior to playing them, when the shot went up in practice, our point guard ran in and boxed out the guy that was simulating Zion for our scout team, and that's an important part too. But fellas, let me tell you something. I've been doing this a long time. I've never seen a kid like that, Zion Williamson, that's so big and so strong with fast twitch muscles like that kid. And this is the most important part. Damn, does he play hard.
Yeah.
He just plays so hard. What a big engine that kid has. And that's the other thing that makes him good, his body, the physicality, the athleticism. But man, does he play hard all of the time.
I remember, Dino, we had Wes Durham on last week, and we were talking about Zion, and he said, think about when Julius Peppers played. Now, tack on this and on this to that frame, and that's Zion Williamson, and we were like, wow, that's putting
NFL
things in perspective.
NFL defensive end kind of stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Hall of Famer. I mean, just –
they can move like that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I think you let the cat out of the bag. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of eyes in these parts here in Nashville at your home court starting on Thursday. Purdue, Tennessee, then the nightcap, Oregon, Virginia. Like I said, I was going to ask you who comes out of Louisville this weekend. I think you just said it. You believe it's Virginia?
I think, and you know, I'm an ACC guy, so don't say this too loud. I think Tennessee.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I just think I just like them so much. I just think like I told you, when we played them in Barclays, there's not a team I was more impressed with all season. And, you know, we played, obviously, three of the number one seeds that came out of the ACC and Carolina, Virginia, and Duke. You know, we played Kentucky, who's really, really good. We played the third best schedule in America. I just really like Tennessee coming out of there. I just think that they're physical. They have the experience. They score at a higher rate than Virginia does. So if it ends up being those two teams, I see, Tennessee coming out of the South.
Wow, that's outstanding. Hey, we've always enjoyed our visits with you over the years. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. If I could help you any time down the road, let me know.
Sounds good. That is Dino Gaudio, Louisville assistant men's basketball coach. Back to wrap up Monday's edition of Darren and Donick next. We need to get back to this. This used to be our song to end every show. Every day. This was the show. This was the bump song. When you heard this.
How far back are you going?
You knew we were wrapping up the show.
The song's from like 2000.
I'm talking about just
2002?
Not too long ago. About a year and a half ago? Year ago?
It's a good song.
I know. We used to end the show with this. Don't you remember? No?
No.
Well, I do.
Okay. I'm a big Coldplay fan. If we want to go with it, let's do it.
I think that was it. No, I just goofed. That was not the song. I'm sorry.
I was going to say.
I'm sorry. I just goofed. My apologies. I feel like Vince now. I should make some type of an excuse. I'm going on 2 hours sleep.
2 hours sleep.
I just got back from Columbus.
Yeah.
Fantasy baseball draft. I can't even say Preds late game. It's not even that excuse. I got no excuse. That was interesting. Dino Gaudio.
Good.
I thought the way he was talking about Virginia, he was letting the cat out of the bag that he likes Virginia to come out of Louisville. But
he threw a curveball. No, he said it the first time, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You misunderstood what he was saying. He said, I like Tennessee. He said, with all due respect.
So I goofed in that interview, too.
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything.
So two straight segments I've goofed.
Yeah. Consecutive segments.
Well, thank goodness this is the last one for today.
Yeah, you can't make it three.
I can reset it and start over tomorrow.
But, you know, here's what I really enjoyed about that, as well as our chat with Casey Alexander earlier in the show. The analysts are great, right? We love having Seth Greenberg and Jimmy Dykes and any number of people that we bring on. But there's really no substitute for a coach who is literally in there doing scouting reports on these teams. They have an extra level of understanding. And think about what he said. Louisville has played Kentucky, Tennessee, all of the ACC teams, and a bunch of other ones. So they've played a bunch of these teams that are still in the tournament. So that was really meaningful insight to me that he thinks Tennessee's coming out of there in a very tough group of teams because they're very familiar with Virginia. We know that. But he thought Tennessee was the most impressive. Now, that game was a long time ago. That was November the 21st on a neutral court, where Tennessee beat Louisville. So we'll see.
Do you remember our conversation with Vince in the third hour about this whole Admiral Schofield not playing at the end and in overtime, right? And everything, the narrative always changes in a win. So, you know, you get the overtime win, and but still, there's a lot of people question. So listen to this, because I'll be honest. I've had a couple of texts saying, what are you hearing on this front? And then sure enough, Rick Barnes has said this in his presser today. Rick Barnes held a presser about 2 hours ago. Rick Barnes said he confirmed in his press conference today that the coaches made the decision to not go with Admiral Schofield on the final possession of regulation. This has gotten twisted in the discussion of Schofield. At some point in overtime, telling coaches to keep the lineup the same. So, remember, in the press conference yesterday, everybody was saying it was Schofield saying, no, just keep Kyle Alexander in.
Right.
You got to keep him in. Well, now is Rick Barnes contradicting and saying it was a coach's decision? Because there are people that have asked me, are you hearing off the record that because Schofield wasn't in there, that he was mad at Rick Barnes, and then in overtime, he kept that anger and said, nah, just, in other words, they're asking, did he refuse to go in? And that's why Alexander was playing.
Only they know, I guess.
Because Rick Barnes now says the decision was made by the coaches for Schofield not to be in there. Well, that wasn't what they were saying yesterday.
There's a lot of possibilities here. You know, a coach at times will take the bullet and say to himself, how do I keep this from being any kind of controversy?
Of any story,
what's
right.
What's the easiest thing for me to say to try to make this go away? And that's one of them. That's one way you can go. He probably did not want to say, yeah, he didn't want to go back in the game. That's
right. You don't want to put that out there.
Because that creates a firestorm there. It's odd enough as it is.
More to come tomorrow. We'll check into this a little deeper dive tomorrow on the program. That is going to do it for us. Everybody have a great rest of your day. Predators and Wild tonight at 7 o'clock. I'll have pregame for you at 6. We'll have a ton to discuss tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. We'll see you then.